Being in South Africa is a long, long way away from California, where Joel Pollack lives, and we really appreciate the fact that he gets, disturbs his sleep pattern to converse with us. But I guess, Joel, sorry, I missed that.
I'm always up at this time. It's not a new sleep pattern.
I thought I was pretty good at being a member of the 5 a.m. club, but you're even earlier than that. But what a week.
How about sleeping in?
What a week we've had here in South Africa. There's all kinds of views on what happened behind closed doors in the White House a week ago, last Wednesday. You've got fabulous connections and contacts and insights within the administration. Can you give us a insider's understanding from the American perspective of actually what happened behind closed doors so that we can get a little closer to the reality?
Well, all I can tell you about that is that the White House was very satisfied with how the meeting went. So they feel that the public portion of the meeting was a success. It achieved what they wanted to achieve. And I think the private portion of the meeting was not particularly important. In fact, I don't think even President Cyril Ramaphosa thought it was important. When he was asked at a press conference what was discussed, he said that the meeting primarily revolved around golf. I don't think that much of substance was discussed in the luncheon and behind closed doors. And I think that's for two reasons. One, the real point from the American side had been the public meeting because of the way South Africa had responded to the Trump administration over the last several months. I think the Trump administration wanted to take the South Africans down a peg or two because the South Africans came into the meeting publicly declaring that they were going to correct the president's misinformation. And that is not a good way to start a negotiation. You don't come to the White House to lecture the president of the United States. It doesn't matter who the president is. So I think they feel that they won a round at South Africa's expense. And that was the point. The other reason is that I don't think the South African team came prepared. And there's been much discussion about whether the South African team was prepared for the quote-unquote ambush that Trump set, although I would argue the South Africans started this ambush business because they came to try to correct Trump, and Ramaphosa had several prominent white South Africans in his delegation. And I almost think that the question that was asked by a South African journalist about the claims of genocide was, in fact, a setup for Ramaphosa, because Ramaphosa didn't wait for Trump to answer. He jumped in and interrupted the president to prepare, to deliver his prepared answer. So it's not just that they didn't prepare for Trump's response. I don't think they prepared for any negotiation at all. I didn't see any proposals from the South African side. None were prepared or delivered. There were no priorities discussed, no issues on the table, no points to raise or things to offer or things to demand. I think the South African side came simply to have the photo opportunity with President Trump and to tell the South African media at home that they had corrected President Trump, that they had stood up for the country. I think from the South African side, that was the point of the visit. And that's why at the end, there was an attempt, and there still is an attempt, to declare the visit a success, even though Ramaphosa basically walked away empty-handed. I mean, there's nothing he took back with him from South Africa, no concessions on trade, no concessions on foreign policy, no resumption of aid, no end to the refugee policy for Afrikaners, nothing. The only thing he's now saying is that President Trump agreed to attend the G20 summit. That's not actually what happened. If you actually look at what they said, and if you look at the transcript of Trump's remarks, he said that he believed it was important for the G20 that the United States was at the summit. But that's not the same as saying he would attend personally. And it's also not the same as saying that anyone from the United States would attend. In a way, it's simply saying yes, you need us to have a successful summit. So it does lean in the direction of possibly attending. So Trump reopened that door, but he didn't commit to attending. And I think actually, in a way, the United States gained leverage in that statement by Trump, because now, instead of being a closed question, it's now an open question, and South Africa might have to offer compromises in order to secure the president's attendance, that is to say, President Trump. But I don't think the South Africans approach this as a serious opportunity to negotiate and to achieve things for South Africa. I think they came to appease a domestic audience of critics, which is interesting, and I think perhaps says a lot about the domestic political situation in South Africa. But they came to attempt to show the South African public that they had stood up to the president. And that's why they were so sort of ambushed in a way, because they tried to set an ambush. And I think the White House knew this was coming. They could sense it was coming. I think the inclusion of the golfers in the delegation, which apparently was at President Trump's suggestion, but the fact that they were given such prominence was a signal to the Americans that Ramaphosa intended to try to manipulate them in some kind of argument, which he did. I mean, it was almost embarrassing to see the way that Ramaphosa racialized the entire meeting by referring, for example, to John Steenhuisen as his white agriculture minister, as if anybody in the room couldn't see that John Steenhuisen was white. I mean, it was sort of crude. And I think the Americans understood this was coming. And so they were prepared with the evidence, not of what AfriForum had said and not of what, you know, some other activists had said or people on the conservative new media right wing of American commentary had said, but Julius Malema. I mean, all they have to do is play Julius Malema. Julius Malema is the best representative of Afrikaner interests, because he tells the world that there's a serious threat and there's nothing South Africa can do about it. The South African government's investigating AfriForum and investigating treasonous misinformation, but they're not investigating Julius Malema, and that was Trump's point. Anyway, that's a very long-winded answer, but the White House is satisfied that they achieved what they wanted to achieve, which is not the same as progress. The White House basically did what they'd wanted to do, which was to stop Ramaphosa from prancing around and claiming some kind of superiority over the American president. And I think they achieved that. I mean, despite efforts in South Africa to say what a great meeting it was and how much was achieved, really nothing of substance was achieved for South Africa. Ramaphosa returned to South Africa with zero, except having, in a sense, damaged the reputation of his country, because the best defense South Africa could offer to the charge of genocide against white farmers was that violent crime, murder, and rape are sort of a general phenomenon in South Africa, not specifically a problem of one group. I mean, it's not really a very good defense. So that's where things are.
Sure. Thank you. It's not long-winded at all. It's very insightful on the perspective that you're seeing there. It has been spun here as a successful meeting, but I don't think too many people are buying that spin. There have been sufficient commentators who've said it was a terrible disaster for South Africa. The heightening of, well, I guess the issues we have to deal with here, terrible issues that we deal with here, now in the forefront around the world. But Joel, the fact that many South Africans spoke and only one American spoke in that whole 45 minutes, do we read anything into that, that President Trump didn't bring any of his colleagues into that discussion?
I think there's nothing much to read into it, except that I think the American side wasn't particularly committed to doing much more in the meeting other than what was done. And they knew that Trump was the best and perhaps the only person to deliver that message. When it came to the Zelensky meeting a few weeks ago, there were many more people involved. Ukraine is an issue in which the entire American government, whether Democratic or Republican now, must be engaged because of the sheer scale of the war, the amount of the expense, the budget burden that it poses, the geopolitical issues involved. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, wasn't there. And I think he had basically said all that he had to say about relations with South Africa. There wasn't more to say or discuss. But yeah, I mean, you make a good observation, which is that the American side had one focus, and they achieved it. And it's also interesting that South Africans didn't bring Sibisi Jonas, who was supposed to be the special envoy. I think on the South African side as well, there was a focus, and the focus was to dispel claims of so-called white genocide. And, you know, of all the excellent South Africans that Ramaphosa could have brought to make the case about how South Africa is doing very well and how it's a dynamic society and so forth, chose to bring these white South Africans, which is fine. I mean, white South Africans are as much a part of South Africa as anybody else, but it was really rather odd. It does tell you that his singular focus was on that question, not on the question of trade and not on the question of growth. I mean, Johann Rupert was there, okay, representing the South African business community. Really, I think the best case for South Africa was made by the head of the trade unions, who was the first person in the meeting to bring up any other issue. She brought up AGOA, she brought up trade, which wasn't really discussed after that, but at least somebody brought it up on the South African side. But I think, again, the American side came to defend itself, and the South African side came to attack. So the notion that Trump ambushed Ramaphosa is only a half-truth. He did ambush Ramaphosa only because Ramaphosa came to set an ambush. And I think that's why the South Africans were shocked. I think what happens in the South African media, and I just say this from some personal experience, is that there's such a bubble and such a lack of real criticism and real diversity, except for shows like yours and others. But essentially, in the South African mainstream media, if you have a critical point of view, you're labeled a racist who wants to bring back apartheid. So nobody wants to be labeled in that way. So there's a lack of discussion. There's a huge amount of abuse heaped on people who criticize the government. Even though the press has a generally oppositional nature, it's very, very difficult to speak up in South Africa. And so the ANC and the people who support it tend to receive feedback from the media, which is that they're doing a wonderful job. And I don't think they came ready for anything other than a beatdown of the American administration. They were prepared, and they believed it was sufficient to show a bunch of white people. They were prepared to have a fight that they thought would be rigged in their favor, like every other debate that they experience. And that was not the case, obviously. So I think the South Africans basically weren't prepared for any broader discussion, and they came to attack. The United States came to defend, and the best person to defend is the president. You don't want to dilute that by having more people speak.
Mm. It's interesting. There was a lot of hope in this country amongst many commentators that President Trump would lay down the law and say, these BEE policies are dreadful. What you're doing against Israel at the ICJ is unacceptable. The farm murders, which you're not taking seriously, need to be taken seriously. And nothing really seems to have been discussed on that front. Were our hopes too high? Those of us who are hoping that after 17 years of declining GDP per capita, we might finally get some kind of sobriety in the union buildings and addressing economic issues? Or would that come at a later stage?
My conclusion after watching the meeting was that the solutions for South Africa and for relations with the United States are going to have to come from outside of the government, both governments. And the reason I came to that conclusion was, I don't think the South African side is prepared to compromise in any way. For whatever reason, Cyril Ramaphosa finds it impossible even to offer small concessions. The idea that the South African side brought up Starlink, for example, to appease Elon Musk and somehow build relations, it's a nice idea, but I don't think that's what actually happened. The South African delegation says Starlink never even came up in discussion, and I believe them. Solly Malatsi, who's the communications minister on the South African side, issued this new policy, but it's only a draft policy. It has yet to be approved. I don't know if it even will be approved, because the opponents of his new policy of relaxing BEE requirements with these BEE equivalent, it seems to be very unpopular within the ANC's rank and file and among other parties outside of the Democratic Alliance, which sees it correctly, I think, as a step in the right direction. But I think there isn't consensus yet on that shift. And I don't think it's enough. I mean, I think it's a good step, but I don't think it's one that the Americans particularly thought was interesting or something that they demanded. I don't think it really amounted to much. And it wasn't offered to Trump in advance either. I mean, there were discussions about it in advance, but it wasn't something that South Africa said during the meeting. It wasn't something they wanted to say publicly or offer publicly. There just wasn't any kind of willingness to compromise. Ramaphosa may simply be a weak president. That is to say, he may be unable to offer compromise because he is afraid of opposition from within. And so he has to present the appearance of control by sticking to a fairly hard line and by constantly citing national sovereignty. You know, he came back from that meeting and then he actually defended Julius Malema's statements as a liberation chant, and he deferred to the courts and so forth. So he managed to do to himself what even Trump hadn't done, which is he made himself equivalent to Julius Malema, at least in the public eye, because now Ramaphosa is on the hook for those statements, having defended them rather than condemning them, as he suggested he might do when he was in the Oval Office. In a very general sense, he said, well, you know, we condemn all such statements because of the Freedom Charter. That's not really a condemnation of kill the Boer or whatever. But I don't think the South African government is willing to compromise for whatever reason. I think they're weak. They're weak internally. They're worried about the far extremes of their party and of other parties. And so they're not going to get much done. On the American side, I think there's a willingness to find solutions, but at the moment there's no interest. And again, the White House seems very satisfied with the way things went, and they're not in any particular hurry to make any other changes, to offer any other compromises, to reach any other deals, because there's no willingness on the South African side. And it's actually better for the United States at this point for South Africa to be yet another cautionary tale. The United States has no choice but to be involved in Ukraine and Russia, but in some ways, Zelensky was also a cautionary tale. One, I think that Ramaphosa heeded by not attacking Trump directly, but I think the question was planted, perhaps, in the press corps so that he would be responding to media questions when he criticized President Trump and not responding directly to the president. But he learned that much, but he didn't really learn that you have to offer compromises. If you want to see a counterexample, look at the UK trade deal that's on the table now between the United States and Keir Starmer's government. Starmer's government didn't actually offer very much, but the point is they offered something and they offered it publicly. And it was met with this welcome embrace by the American administration. And it's now being used as an example for other countries to follow. So now Trump is looking for trade deals with other countries who will do similar things, offer similar compromises. It wasn't really much to offer what Starmer offered, what the UK offered. Ramaphosa is somehow unable to make the same move. So the Americans aren't interested in moving forward right now because they are using South Africa as an example of why not to oppose the Trump administration. South Africa is basically in a very bad position. It's placed itself in a bad position. And those of us who'd like to see some progress in the relationship are coming to the conclusion that if that happens, it's going to happen from private individuals. It's going to happen from outside of the government, from people building connections with the United States and South Africa, between the United States and South Africa, and then essentially making those connections publicly known or making public proposals to repair the relationship that one hopes would develop enough momentum to the point where the governments have to respond favorably. In a way, the Starlink proposal is something like that. I think people were talking about it enough in the business community that at least a portion of the South African government felt it had an opportunity to move the ball forward. But I think that there are going to have to be more intense and more public discussions between business communities on both sides about what needs to happen in the relationship between South Africa and the United States for the governments to take a more sincere and intense interest in fixing that relationship. And really, more specifically, it has to be something that's going to prompt the South African government to offer compromises, because I don't think you're going to be able to move the White House off of where it is. You know, you mentioned that the White House wasn't interested in the other issues, didn't discuss the ICJ case. Trump simply said, well, he didn't expect anything and he'd let the case run its course and so forth. I think there were other issues. I mean, we had a reporter in the Oval Office who asked, what compromises do you want to see South Africa make? And the president used that question to deliver a very long-winded answer against the South African government's policies, but didn't specify any particular compromises. I think the singular focus of the White House was on defending itself against Ramaphosa's argument that the White House was essentially being misinformed by Afrikaners, which, you know, he didn't spell out specifically, but that's the implication. And I think the White House took great umbrage at that. And I think that's why they were focused on that one issue. So if you really want to make progress on trade and you want to make progress on foreign relations and so forth, you have to offer more. You know, South Africa began the meeting well. I actually thought Ramaphosa began well by praising Trump's efforts to negotiate peace and talking about how Zelensky had come to South Africa and so forth. But what did South Africa offer? Did South Africa offer to host the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority to discuss? I mean, I don't know if either side would accept the invitation, but did South Africa offer something like that? Did South Africa offer to join international pressure on Iran, on stopping it from achieving a nuclear weapon? I mean, what did he actually offer? He offered nothing. So there is going to have to be a concerted effort by people in the private sector, I think, on both sides, to say what actually are the steps that South Africa must take to bring the American administration around once again to developing a stronger relationship that can then lead to economic growth and flourishing in South Africa and to better trade relations between the two countries.
Sure, that's quite a lot to digest, Joel, but I guess if I were to summarize, it was an opportunity lost. There certainly has been some pretty negative information that was disclosed there to the rest of the world. When you've got your own people saying we're a terribly violent society where people get raped and murdered, it isn't a good message to be sending out. But if I hear you correctly, South Africa is not that important to the United States. And as a result, come the deadline for tariffs, we might be stuck with the 30% that has been proposed. Is that a correct reading?
I think so. I think it's more important to the Trump administration right now to have achieved a public victory over a South African government that was intransigent, and thereby to set an example to other countries not to follow South Africa's lead, than it is to have repaired the relationship with South Africa. So I think South Africa is actually in a very bad place after that visit and needs to find an answer quickly if it wants to avoid the tariffs, if it wants to repair relations, perhaps even make a pitch for restoring some of the aid that was lost. I think South Africa needs to offer some compromises and quickly. That would be my approach. The White House hasn't said that. I think the White House is quite satisfied with how things turned out. And to the extent that the South African media are spinning the meeting as a success for South Africa, that's going to prevent the kind of change that would actually improve relations between the two countries. South Africa should not rest on its so-called laurels. I mean, you know, it was not a successful meeting. And, you know, the Trump base, Trump's MAGA supporters and so forth, are enjoying the video clips of that meeting, which tells you that the American side is in a sense relishing a victory. It's not concerned with what it can do to fix the relationship. They believe that South Africa came for a fight and got one and came out the losing end. So if I were the South African government or advising the South African government, I would say that the Starlink proposal is a step in the right direction. There need to be other such proposals, and they need to receive the full endorsement of the South African government. Also, crucially, stop avoiding the issue of Julius Malema. The fact that Ramaphosa came out and defended Malema's rhetoric by saying it's just a liberation chant and deferred to the courts. You know, the courts in South Africa have until now enjoyed a good international reputation, but the decisions on the Kill the Boer chant are indefensible. And now attention is being drawn to the fact that Julius Malema actually sits on the Judicial Services Commission. So he's choosing the judges. And that is now understood as perhaps having played a role in affecting the outcome of the legal cases against him. But even if you don't want to arrest him, as Trump said, South Africa should, there needs to be a much firmer stance against that kind of rhetoric, and not simply defending it as a sort of liberation chant. I mean, again, Ramaphosa has now equated himself to Malema on this issue by defending the indefensible. And if you don't want to have people believe there's a white genocide, then don't describe a chant that is obviously violent in its imagery as some kind of freedom song. It's offensive and it sends a terrible signal to the rest of the world. So that's not a difficult compromise to make. I mean, what are you going to do? Make Malema angrier at the government than he already is? Just stand up to him. But somehow that's beyond what Ramaphosa is willing to do. I mean, that's, again, very strong advice. I would not continue in that vein. I think the White House has taken note of that. They view Ramaphosa's unwillingness to condemn the statement as a sort of rebuke to the president, because the president made it very clear, President Trump made it very clear that he did not like that statement. He did not want to see it repeated. He wanted South Africa to do something about it. And Ramaphosa has come home and simply refused. And, you know, when Trump disagrees with something, he goes on a Truth Social and he writes a very angry post in all caps letters. And it's not hard. I mean, that's what he does. And people agree or disagree, but at least he has made his own view very clear. Ramaphosa, at least for now, has taken the view that kill the Boer, kill the farmer, shoot to kill, that's all right. It's part of ordinary political discourse in South Africa. I mean, it's not a way to achieve progress.
What about the next step in this whole process? Because clearly South Africa has not moved. The ANC has not moved. The next step, Ronnie Jackson's bill that is being proposed at Congress at the moment, is how far along the path is that? Is it ever likely to be passed? And indeed, would that be the next or the first proper step in maybe shaking up this government to see the world as it is, not as they would like it to be?
I don't know. It's a good question. There's the Ronnie Jackson bill. There are one or two other bills. I don't know if they are going to move through Congress with any kind of speed. The Republican Congress is probably inclined to defer to the administration on matters of foreign policy. The only time you see Congress, whether Democratic or Republican, really move quickly on foreign policy is if there's broad public disagreement with the administration. So, for example, during the first Trump administration, Congress moved very quickly to pass resolutions against the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia, because the Democrats and enough Republicans, but mainly it was the Democrats, believed suddenly, after years of tolerating Saudi human rights abuses, that the Saudis had to pay for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And so they moved these bills through Congress with great speed and they were passed. They didn't really have any effect on American foreign policy in the end, because the president has broad foreign policy powers. They're limited to some extent by the Constitution, but essentially it's one of the areas where the president has broadest power. But that moved through very quickly. In this case, you have a Republican president who agrees generally with the sentiment of the Republican Congress. And so those kinds of resolutions are mostly intended to send a signal about what the preferred policy of the majority party is. They send a signal about congressional support for the president's policy, but I don't think they really need to be passed or voted on to achieve their intended effect. It's not to say they won't be voted on. They could be attached to other legislation and they could pass in that way. But I don't see that happening before the White House acts. I think the likeliest next step on the American side, especially as you see Ramaphosa effectively endorsing Malema, is you're going to see some harsher responses to South African policies and South African rhetoric. And I don't think the South Africans are going to like it. And I think the talk of South Africa having won a round or having had a successful meeting, I think it's going to end fairly quickly. You know, I saw Adrian Basson of News 24 talking about how, because Trump didn't comment on the ICJ case, that meant the U.S. was finally taking seriously the idea that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. I mean, that's laughable. Just look at what's happening in Gaza. The United States is there this week on the ground helping the Israelis distribute aid outside of the United Nations so that the Israeli military can go through neighborhood by neighborhood and root out Hamas from the Gaza Strip. The United States is in Gaza, not directly in a military sense, but American contractors are in Gaza with the blessing of the administration, which wants everyone to know that they're there, and they are helping circumvent the United Nations aid distribution mechanism so that an Israeli military operation can succeed, a military operation that South Africa is trying to stop by calling it genocide. So, you know, there's this fantasy that somehow the meeting went very well for all of South Africa's priorities. It's just completely at odds with reality. And I think the likely next step from the American side is unfortunately going to be harsh for South Africa. And South African media are going to have to explain to their public what happened, why it is that the Americans are not being friendly to South Africa when Ramaphosa was supposed to have gone and achieved all this great stuff for the South African people. I mean, again, he came away with nothing except a vague commitment that America might attend the G20 summit. It was not a public commitment to do so by the president, and certainly there was not a personal commitment to do so. And I've actually asked the White House to clarify, and they have not wanted to clarify. I think they prefer the ambiguity because it gives them leverage. So I think that's where things are. So, you know, if there's any gain that South Africa made, it was perhaps that. But I actually view that as a gain for the United States, because the ambiguity means that South Africa will have to offer compromises in order to entice Trump to attend.
So it wouldn't surprise you. We have one of our contributors, John Mattison, who got to speak for the first time with someone who was in the room behind to Steenhuisen, John Steenhuisen, who told him there was no animosity, there was no antagonism in the meetings. He said the discussions were to do with tariffs and to reducing the tariffs. It sounds really strange, but reducing the tariffs on U.S. vehicles being brought into South Africa. In other words, it seems very margin-y. And from what Steenhuisen is now telling us happened behind closed doors, it appears to confirm everything that you've explained, that really they've achieved what they wanted to. Now it's just, you know, muddling on. And the South Africans should not regard anything having changed, that in fact they will probably be setting out some pretty hectic tariffs come, 60 days' time.
Yeah, I'll make two observations about that. You know, sometimes, you know, it was told to me once that if you don't have a friendship with some arguments, then it's not a real friendship. So the fact that it was pleasant and nice and cordial behind closed doors tells me that it wasn't serious. When President Trump has spoken to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the last few days, and really those two are quite close and the two countries are very close, the reports are that they have had very direct arguments with one another about the future of American negotiations with Iran in the Middle East. The Israelis are very nervous that Trump's going to reach a deal that will cut them out and make it hard for them to respond militarily to what they see as a growing threat. So there are frank and difficult conversations. That's what happens in a friendship, in a very close relationship, where you have differences, you hash them out. When you're not hashing them out, when you're not having those hard conversations, you don't actually have a very close relationship. So I think to the extent the conversations were cordial, I mean, that's very nice, but it also means that nothing really is happening. A word about John Steenhuisen, again, who I have a great deal of respect for. I think he did the best job within the cabinet at the meeting when he pointed out to President Trump that the reason for the Democratic Alliance's participation in the government of national unity was precisely to keep Malema out of the government. That was an important point to make, and it was the most effective point the South African side made about the degree to which there have been efforts to marginalize Malema. I don't think it convinced anybody, and it certainly won't convince people once Ramaphosa comes back to home soil and is defending what Malema says effectively. But one negative point I'd say about Steenhuisen's involvement was he allowed himself to be used as a kind of racial prop, you know, and I thought it was ugly. I think it was actually offensive. If I were him, I would be offended. Not that it's necessary to take offense at small things. I don't think it was a small thing to be presented to the world as the white agriculture minister. You know, I think that that's not where South Africa wants to be. And it was clear in advance, again, because of the way Ramaphosa was speaking, because of the composition of the delegation, I think it was clear that that's how he was going to be used. And so he allowed himself to be used in that way. Now, he did speak up again, and I think he made the most effective point in South Africa's defense. But I think that the role that the Democratic Alliance wants in the government of national unity has to be something more than to be a kind of white fig leaf for bad policies. I just think it's ugly and it doesn't serve anybody's interests.
Just to close off with, the Western Cape independence issue now seems to be growing and growing, because if there is going to be no change in the rest of South Africa, the one part of the country that is working, the one part of the country that did not vote for the ANC, and the ANC is down to below 20% in that province, they are now saying, okay, you've seen it. We could be friends with the United States. We're not going to be because of the guys who are up north. We need to redouble our efforts. Do you think there would be any support from the United States were that movement to gather momentum?
I think it would have to gather serious political momentum in South Africa. I don't see any real interest in it right now within the administration. There's no talk about it. There's no effort to pressure anyone to make anything happen. It's not being considered. Now, if it were on the table, I think the Americans would look at it more closely. Effectively, though, you know, I had a friend who traveled to South Africa actually last week around the time of the meeting, and I asked him, oh, where are you going? He said, I'm going to Cape Town, and then I'm going to the Kruger Park. So, you know, effectively, in the American imagination, that's the part of South Africa you want to visit. You want to visit the Western Cape and the Kruger Park, and the rest of the country you just fly over or you skip over. That's not good for South Africa. So effectively, there is a kind of focus on the Western Cape, plus the natural beauty of the far northeast of the country. But you know, it's not good. It's not good. So economically, there already is a kind of separation between the Western Cape and the rest of the country. But as for political independence, I don't see much interest there just yet.
Joel Pollack is senior editor at Breitbart. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.